Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, Myanmar's rebels take on its government.
What these people want now is a real federal Myanmar that encompasses everybody.
Why is Myanmar's government struggling to keep rebel forces at bay? I'm Kevin Hurton, and this is The Take. The city of Mayawati is on Myanmar's border with Thailand. A pair of bridges span the river, connecting it to the Thai town of Mae Sot. Al Jazeera correspondent Tony Chang visited it for the first time in 2008, sneaking in as a tourist because of restrictions on reporting there.
It was a very different place. There was trade going across the border and a considerable amount of it, but there were people living in bamboo shacks on top of small ponds that they would keep fish in. It was very undeveloped, dirt roads, very few tarmac roads even. In the last 15, 16 years, it's grown into, you know, a very sophisticated city. There's a lot of border trade. Thais who go to do duty-free shopping on the other side, and other tourists, a lot of tourists from China, for example, who are attracted by the casino businesses that have grown up on the edge of the city.
And it's an indicator of the country's fortunes.
There's a direct line from here to Yangon, the biggest city inside Myanmar. A massive amount of trade went across that border. I mean, some years ago, it was estimated that 40% of Myanmar's GDP came this way. Now, I think it's estimated that trade is worth well over $1 billion.
More recently, Tony has been reporting from just across the border in the town of Mae Sot in Thailand on what's going on in Myanmar.
The remaining Myanmar junta soldiers are, we understand, just across this bridge here. This is Friendship Bridge 2. And there were reports earlier this morning that they had fled their battalion and come here to ask the Thai military to let them flee into Thai territory.
This is my second visit in the last 7 days because it's been very much the focus of our attention recently. One of the ethnic armies fighting against the military junta managed to push the military out of the town.
This is a fighter with one of the rebel groups, the People's Defense Force.
What we are doing is for the future of our country and people, and that motivation helps overcome the fear.
Partly because of the difficulty of reporting inside Myanmar, this is not a conflict that has received much attention compared to other wars going on. But now, it seems things may be moving quickly. Tony, I wonder if we can start by describing this conflict in the broadest possible strokes. This has been described as a civil war. So can you just give us some basics? When did the war start? Who is fighting against each other and why?
I mean, that is a really complicated question. But in very simple terms, the military launched a coup in 2021 on the 1st of February. It was when the new parliament was supposed to sit for the first time, a parliament that had been elected in November the year before.
After nearly a decade sharing power with civilians, Myanmar's military staged a coup, setting up checkpoints, taking over TV stations, which played military propaganda, and detaining civilian officials, including their leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
Suddenly, we saw on our screens images of the military sweeping into Naypyidaw, closing down parliament, soldiers on the street. And then there was a period of a couple of days when I think everyone was slightly shocked. Myanmar had been very much on the path to democracy. It was a flawed democracy. I think everyone understood that. But, you know, it had taken great strides in recent years. Barack Obama had been there and praised the changes that had happened.
Barack Obama has heaped praise on Myanmar for its reforms during his landmark visit. It's the first time a sitting American president has visited the country, and he met with pro-democracy opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who led the struggle against military rule.
Suddenly everything locked down, and then we started to see protests on the street. And the protesters made a very big point of saying, we're peaceful protesters. The military kind of took it for a week or two, and then they started to push back. Then you saw police going in with tear gas, with armored vehicles, with big water cannon on the top, with batons. Then about a month later, the first shots were fired, the first casualties fell. And before long, those casualties were falling in larger and larger numbers every day. That has evolved over the last 2 years into a very bitter armed conflict. To expand that even wider, it's complicated by the fact that Myanmar has had for over half a century sort of seething ethnic conflicts on its borders, particularly the borders with Thailand.
Now, the latest violence has been centered in the town of Miawadi. That's in Myanmar, which shares the border with Thailand's Mae Sot.
So there are ethnic groups across the river from where I am at the moment called the Karen, a little higher up called the Kareni on the Chinese border, the Kachin, the Chin on the border with India. A lot of these people felt that they weren't being adequately represented, and there had been low-level insurgencies that simmered. What we saw after the coup was when these peaceful protesters were being gunned down by a military who clearly were not going to stop. A lot of them fled out of the cities into the countryside, and they found their way to these armed groups.
So you have a coup followed by protests, followed by armed conflict. And what sets this conflict apart from maybe what happened in the past is that the pro-democracy protesters have now joined forces with the ethnic militias in the borderlands that have been fighting since the beginning of Myanmar.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So there was a small flame there on the border areas, which has just been fanned by the military coup. I think what's interesting now is all of those little insurgencies all had different goals. We're all at various stages of ceasefire agreements with the military, with the civilian government. Now there's a real unity. And I was speaking to some of these guys this evening, and there's a real fire that's burning inside them. They have a united goal. Now, I think that's not to say that the future holds many complications for Myanmar, but these are people who saw the benefits of democratic changes that came since 2015, then saw it snuffed out and realized there's no way out of this.
Can you just tell me about the sort of strange geography of the conflict? I know that the military government forces are sort of aligned in the center, but they're surrounded on both sides.
That's true now. That wasn't the case, I mean, even as recently as 6 months ago. What happened was that in one area in northern Shan State, a couple of these groups started pushing back and had huge success.
The operation initiated by the Northern Alliance, codenamed 1027 to mark today's date, comes as Myanmar's army struggles to suppress resistance to its rule.
They managed to push the military out of strategic positions in Shan State all the way up to the Chinese border. There was a certain level of coordination, but I think there was also just a feeling in other parts of Myanmar that if they can do it, we can do it too. And we've seen that happen. And the culmination was Miawadi, which is just across the border from where I am, which I think most people would consider as the most important border crossing, and it's fallen into rebel hands.
Okay, so you talked about the surprising unity that you're seeing amongst the pro-democracy and ethnic militias. What about the other side of the conflict? What about the military junta? Why do you think that they're having so much trouble containing this conflict where they had success in the past?
Part of it is just numbers. We know that morale has been very low. Conscription rates into the military have been very low. And at the beginning of this year, they announced a new conscription law that was supposed to boost their numbers. Instead, what's happened is a lot of people have fled from the cities, those that remained in the areas under military control, and have either come across the borders into neighboring countries, particularly in Thailand, or have gone to fight for those ethnic armies or the People's Defense Forces, the pro-democracy militias that you mentioned. Because I think, you know, what the military has done is forced them further and further into a corner where they've really got no choice other than to fight.
Yeah. I mean, look, despite everything, there's a huge mismatch. Do you think that these pro-democracy groups could really overthrow this government?
I think you just have to look at what's happened in the last 6 months. they forced the military out of all of their borders. So there is now a corridor that runs from the capital, Naypyidaw, down to the most populated city, Yangon, that the military control. They are present in a lot of other places, but they are often sheltering in military bases. They need a lot of support. That is astonishing when you think that this is a fully operating military with tanks, armored vehicles, a huge array of weaponry, heavy artillery, and fighter jets, fighter helicopters, attack helicopters. And they're essentially fighting opponents who have at best machine guns. Myanmar's geography helps. It is a very mountainous country covered by thick jungle, so there are lots of places to hide. I think what we're probably going to see in the next little while is rebel forces, and I use that term rather reluctantly because they hate being called rebels. They feel entirely justified in the fight.
Yeah.
But it's trying to find a collective term. But where they may well control everywhere outside the cities, and the military hold on to the cities.
Where does that leave the pro-democracy forces in Myanmar, including deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi? That's after the break.
Get your news in less than 3 minutes, three times per day, with the Al Jazeera News Updates. Just ask your home device to play the news by Al Jazeera or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, Tony, it seems the rebels have managed to get close to the military's capital in the city of Naypyidaw. It was reported that they have moved Aung San Suu Kyi. She, of course, is the controversial Nobel Peace Prize winner who is now back under arrest.
She may not be free, but Aung San Suu Kyi's detention conditions appear to have improved. Myanmar's former leader is no longer in prison. Instead, she's been transferred to a government building.
Aung San Suu Kyi was moved to a high-level venue compound on Monday night.
She's been moved from an unknown location from the prison where she was being held. So what do you think this says about the mindset in the junta at this stage?
Well, the official response was that she was moved along with a whole lot of other prisoners, including the former president, because of her age and because of the heat. There's a heat wave going on in Southeast Asia at the moment.
State media, quoting a spokesman for the junta, said extremely hot weather had caused Ms. Suu Kyi and other elderly prisoners to be relocated as a precaution against heatstroke. The Nobel laureate's been...
It also happened at the Burmese New Year, a time when there's a certain relaxation of the conditions around prisoners. I think a lot of people are interpreting that, though, as maybe the opening signs that they may want to negotiate with her. She is probably the only channel they could use to speak to these pro-democracy groups, but also the other ethnic parties involved in the fight. That said, she's been in isolation since February the 1st, 2021. We don't know what she knows about what's going on. We don't really know what state of health she's in. Aung San Suu Kyi is a 78-year-old woman who has spent a large part of her life in detention, under house arrest, even in prison. When she was going to court a couple of years ago, there was the suggestion that she did have some health problems. That presumably hasn't been helped by the time she spent in jail. So I think there's a real concern there that there is a health problem, but it does also suggest that the military might want to open a means, an avenue to talk.
So, Tony, we talked about both sides of the conflict, but there is a sort of an X factor that's happening in this chaos of civil war, which is organized crime. I know that organized crime groups are moving in, and that is actually ruffling some feathers, especially with China.
China says it wants to cooperate with Myanmar to restore stability in a border region. The region is important to Beijing due to trade links with Myanmar and because it's part of the global Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this is, I think, possibly something that the military didn't consider. We've seen crime in Myanmar for years. It's been a drug-producing area for decades. What was a huge opium trade has now turned into a methamphetamine trade.
Chaos and lawlessness have turned the Southeast Asian nation into one of the biggest drug hotspots in the world. Chaos in the country has allowed narcotics gangs to thrive, producing a narcotics market bigger than Mexico.
But with the coup, we also saw large areas of the country basically being governed by the criminal gangs that had prospered in the drug trade. And they, in turn, were renting out space, basically, space in their cities, to Chinese crime syndicates who were setting up scam centers, basically massive phone centers where they're cold calling people on the internet through social media to scam people out of money.
Held in prison-like dorms, they were forced to run scams from formulas worked out by the gang, crypto, stocks, and romance. One of their victims lost more than $80,000, but the scammers had no choice.
It's an industry which Interpol says in Southeast Asia is worth $3 trillion a year. But to put that into context, that's just a little under the GDP of France, which is $3 trillion, I think. The UN said last year that 120,000 people had been trafficked into Myanmar to serve these scam centers. What we saw last year was the Chinese government eventually losing their patience with Myanmar because they had warned the military to get a control of these scam centers, a lot of which were directing their attentions back into China.
Ethnic armies near the border with China launched an offensive against the military last October, and Chinese officials have since brokered a truce among the warring parties. Observers say the attacks caught the Myanmar army by surprise. Military forces were weakened, resulting in defeats and surrenders in parts of Shan State.
We don't know exactly what China's involvement was in the offensive that happened in October. If nothing else, they turned a blind eye, and that made a very significant difference and allowed the groups in Shan State to turn against the military. Mm. Well, and I think the military thought they might get some support from China. That certainly wasn't there. And that was the first domino to fall in what has been a very bad 6 months militarily for the junta.
Oh, my goodness. So look, we tend to talk about these conflicts like they're pieces on a chessboard, and we look at maps and we look at the different forces and who's won this battle. But can you talk about how bad the situation is just for normal people?
For landmine victim Sei Ka Lu, the prospect of rushing back to his former home village is inconceivable.
If we really have no choice and we have to leave this camp, it's going to be very difficult for me to go back. I definitely can't go back to our original home or land because the Burmese soldiers are still there. I'm afraid to go back.
I was speaking to people this evening who were describing a situation where even at night, the military is bombing targets. And when I said, you know, how do they know where they're bombing, the answer was they often don't. They're just indiscriminately bombing. And they have full control in the air. There's no one to challenge them. In vast parts of the country, there's no electricity. There's no running water. There's no healthcare because in the period after the coup, a lot of doctors joined the civil disobedience movement and fled from government-controlled areas. Even if there were doctors, there certainly aren't any medical supplies. There's very little fuel. There's no education. You can think about that in areas, small areas of isolation in other places. But that's the reality for most people inside Myanmar now.
How come this can be such a massive conflict and it's about democracy versus a military autocracy, and yet we just don't pay attention to it?
That is a question a lot of people from inside Myanmar ask me. They say, why does no one care about what's happening in our country? You know, we saw President Obama come to Yangon to praise what had happened. Aung San Suu Kyi was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And we are fighting for that ideal that everyone was saying we should look up for. And we're not getting any support at all.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by David Enders and Khalid Sultan, with Nagin Oliayi, Sonia Bhagat, Suri Al-Khalili, Amy Walters, Chloe K. Lee, Ashish Malhotra, Faranisa Kampana, Zainab Adar, Manahil Navid, Catherine Nguyen, and me, Kevin Hurton, in for Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Alexander Locke is The Take's executive producer. And Ney Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back.